Ms. Melton, good morning to you. And before you begin, to Mr. Nygaard, good morning to you. Do either council have any questions before we begin?
No, Your Honor.
Then, Ms. Melton, you may proceed.
Thank you. I would like to reserve time for rebuttal, please. 2 minutes, please. May it please the court, Chief Justice Hevekin, Your Honors, and counsel. My name is Amy Melton. I am here with my co-counsels, Ronald Reagan and Megan Shoup. We represent the appellants, Cheryl Bettine and Nancy Miles. The facts in this case are that our clients are sisters who inherited their father's home as tenants in common with their brother, Robert Moniger. Robert Moniger received a life estate, and he was to pay all of the taxes on the home. There was no mortgage on the home, so it was free and clear. However, Robert failed to pay those taxes. Appellee Boone River received a tax certificate sale, or received a tax certificate in 2015 for the purchase price of approximately $2,800. Robert failed to redeem the property, and the treasurer's tax deed was issued to Boone River in August of 2018. In October of 2018, Boone River transferred the property by warranty deed to an LLC called 11T&E. Boone River received $195,500 as the purchase price according to the real estate transfer statement. And then in December of 2018, 11T filed a complaint against our clients and their brother, Robert, seeking quiet title as well as ejecting Robert from the property. Our clients were served, and that was the first time they received any notice that the taxes had not been paid. At that time, they filed a counter-complaint alleging improper notice. They also posted a bond in the sum of approximately $20,000 with the clerk of Douglas County District Court to cover any back taxes, interest, and costs pursuant to case law that we read that said if you're seeking equity, you also have to do equity. So we posted that bond with the district court. In June of 2019, a summary judgment was granted in favor of our clients, and the tax treasurer's deed was void for following the procedures set forth in statutes and failing to make diligent inquiry to locate our clients. After the appellate time, we then filed a motion to release the bond. The day before that motion was scheduled, that motion hearing was scheduled, we did receive the deeds, the quitclaim deeds from the plaintiffs. And the next day, they failed to show up for the motion to release the funds. They failed to file any objection for the release of funds. And in their original action, they didn't add any claims for unjust enrichment. And we had all of the same parties that are here today. In the original action, we actually brought Boone River and Guardian taxpayers into our original case as defendants. 3 months later, after the bond was released to our clients, in November of 2019, Boone River and 11T as joint plaintiffs filed this action against my clients and their brother claiming unjust enrichment. Then during the depositions in this matter, it became clear that there was no evidence that Boone River or 11T actually paid all of the taxes. There's multiple other entities that weren't part of this, and they pay each other and they pay taxes. So even the comptroller wasn't clear as to who paid them, and the county treasurer said they don't keep record of who actually pays the taxes, just whether the taxes were received.
Your clients didn't pay the taxes, though. Is that correct?
Our clients did not the original, yes, not the taxes that the tax deed was filed upon. That is correct. We just posted a bond in the amount that we estimated, including interest and expenses, when we filed the case. So after the depositions were taken, then there was an assignment. So it became clear that a company named Home Buyers is the one that actually paid the taxes. So after our depositions, Home Buyers Inc. then did an assignment to 11T, who was the plaintiff in this instant case. Then on or about the day of trial in this matter, Boone River's parent company, Enterprise Inc., did an assignment to Boone River, I guess just cleaning up to make sure that the plaintiffs, which kind of goes into my other arguments on joinder. But after a trial in the matter, our clients were, after some discussion on what the amount should be, were ordered to pay approximately $16,000 in unjust enrichment.
Could you take me through your claim preclusion theory?
Yes. So the appellees should have been precluded from bringing this action under the principles of claim preclusion, which bars relitigating of any matter directly addressed or included in the former adjudication. We had, it was a court of competent jurisdiction. It was a final judgment. It was void and, you know, with prejudice. The former judgment was on the merits, and the same parties and their privies were involved in both actions. And what my argument is going to be...
But the issue of who paid the taxes was not before the court at that point, correct?
Well, I would argue that it was before the court due to the fact that we actually posted the bond with the district court or with the district clerk. I think that we put it there, that the taxes are at issue. And I think even with the motion to release the funds, they had every opportunity to even request at that time, well, we should at least get our taxes back, Your Honor. You shouldn't release all of the funds back to them. We should get at least what we paid.
So does claim preclusion include actions that could have been brought?
I believe so. Any actions, and I think that's what in Bowling versus Tecumseh, just in April of 2023, this court stated that that doctrine applied. And that, by the way, even if a party fails to appeal an erroneous dismissal, preclusion still applies.
It applies to actions that could have been brought if it's the same cause of action. Right. Well, it's not if I have a tort claim against you and a breach of contract claim against you and they have no connection one to another, I'm not obligated to bring both of those under claim preclusion if it's the same cause of action, right?
Well, I would argue that in Schaefer versus Frakes, that was just this year, that this court, Judge Funk specifically opined that the Nebraska court pleadings permit parties to plead as many separate claims and defenses a party has, regardless of consistency. And I think the whole point of claim preclusion is that if you have the same parties in the same action, and by the way, they got the tax deed due to non-payment of taxes. So I think we are saying that it's the same issues. Whether my clients paid the taxes or didn't pay the taxes is how they got the tax deed. Now, they didn't follow the proper statutory procedures. I think that in order to potentially protect their argument for unjust enrichment when they filed quitclaim deeds against property owners that failed to pay their taxes, they probably should also argue for unjust enrichment in the event that they fail to get quiet title and the deed is found void.
I might not be keeping up with you, but let me ask, are these the same parties in the sense that they are in the same roles? In other words, this saga opens up with the ladies as Tick, right? Tennis and Cabin, right? And then pretty soon they look like owners via a deed. Are they the same parties?
So I would say they are the same parties because it was two sisters and a brother. They are tenants in common. The brother had the life estate. But the parties in the first action before Judge Pankinen in the district court are the same parties that are in this unjust enrichment action. And I think that's also because in the original action, we filed to bring Boone River in as a third-party defendant. I would argue that had our clients not posted the bond, not brought in Boone River and the other third-party defendants, that you might have an argument. There might be an argument that it's not claim preclusion. However, I believe that our clients did everything in order to prevent a second litigation. And I would also like to argue, just in regards to the unjust enrichment, I would say unjust enrichment is not proper merely under a rule of general fairness or because the benefits to a person sought to be charged amount to a windfall. I mean, I think it's quite ironic that the appellees certainly don't ever concede that they are unjustly enriched when they reap the windfall of the equity in the other cases in which they prevail on these tax deeds, yet they wish to be reimbursed for unjust enrichment when they fail to abide by the statutory requirements in obtaining the tax deed.
Doesn't the requirement that your clients have to tender the back taxes, isn't that sort of an indication that the law recognizes an entitlement that even if the deed fails, that the tax certificate purchaser is entitled to the taxes they paid?
I would agree, but I think that they needed to have made that argument then in the first case where the money is actually there.
That's a preclusion argument, not a lack of unjust enrichment argument, right?
Well, but even if you find, like in Zook, in the case of Zook, where it appeared that he was unjustly enriched, even if you find that it may not be fair and somebody else may have received the money.
So your argument is that in this case, in the first case, if Boone River and 11T would have pled in the alternative, even if our deed fails or even if our deed is void, we're entitled to unjust enrichment, that they wouldn't have been entitled to recover the taxes?
No, we actually even offered that. We anticipated.
I'm asking, would they have been entitled to recover the taxes if they'd alleged it in the first action?
I believe if they alleged it in the first action, they would actually have to prove, though, who paid what, which is another argument that we have, that it's not clear who paid what, because it appears that Boone River actually received $195,000 from 11T, so I don't think they were out any money. So at this point, the only real evidence we have is that 11T paid approximately $1,400. That's the only plaintiff that we have. So that's another issue that we would have to deal with. But I would argue that they still have to prove that our clients did some misleading act, requested the services. Our client didn't ask for the taxes to be paid. I think the taxes were paid in order to protect their investment in the deed. So they were paying those taxes for self-serving purposes, not for the benefit of our clients. I believe my time is up. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Odgard, good morning again.
May it please the court, my name is Mark Odgard. I am here on behalf of the Appalese. And I would like to begin where we sort of left off with counsel, and that's addressing the collateral estoppel issue. The facts of this case are sort of akin to a law school exam because there were so many entities that were involved.
What does the record tell us about why there were so many entities involved?
Sure. Essentially a corporate structure, Your Honor, that's chosen by that by the company in order to sort of do business. And if I may, essentially what the facts are is that Boone River is the one that paid the taxes on the tax certificate. There's a great deal of information contained in the appellant's brief contesting that. What is important here is that Amy Wyman, the employee for the treasurer's office, testified clearly that Boone River was in fact the party that paid those taxes. It's also evident through the receipts. They are Exhibit 4 in the Bill of Exceptions. They have pay dates on those receipts. Ms. Wyman testified to the fact that payments were made in March of 2015 as well as October of 2015. Prior to the time that Boone River was purchased by this Guardian Tax Partners. So essentially what the testimony is and what the evidence reflects is that Boone River in fact was the party that paid for the tax certificate monies alone. Boone River conveyed that property to 11TNE LLC by corporate warranty deed. They did that on October 31st of 2018. So 11T, when they filed that initial claim in 18-10480, it was a quiet title action at 11T, which had nothing to do with the taxes, the tax certificate, or anything that was paid prior to that.
Are all these related entities?
These two parties are they're sister entities. There is some common ownership in between those. 11T, when it filed,
are they in privity with one another for preclusion purposes?
Well, I'm getting there, Judge. but essentially, the preclusion issue itself, and I apologize for not including these cases in my brief. There are two cases that I think are directly on point for this case, because the first is Schreiner versus Friedman Law Offices, 23 NEBAP 869/2016. That case states that we agree with the approach adopted by a number of states and federal courts declining to apply claim preclusion to permissive cross claims not asserted in a prior action. Part of the rationale for such an approach is that the contrary rule would, in essence, render otherwise permissive cross-claims mandatory. Thus, because a contrary rule would effectively abolish the permissive cross-claim rule embodied in 6.1113G, we conclude that claim preclusion does not apply to permissive cross-claims that could have been raised in a former action but were not. Therefore, the claim preclusion does not bar Schreiner's legal malpractice action. I mention that because that's the exact same rule of pleadings which which are at issue today. Now, this wasn't a cross-claim, it was a counterclaim, and it was a third-party claim against the defendant, Boone River. They have the exact same language in that counterclaim. They have the exact same language in A, B, and E. And those provisions actually specifically address that a party who does not assert a counterclaim that arises out of the transaction or occurrence, that is the subject matter of an opposing party's claim, cannot recover costs against the party in a subsequent action thereon. It also then talks about how a claim which matured or was acquired by the pleader after filing a pleading may, with the permission of the court, be presented as a counterclaim by supplemental pleading. And the United States District Court of Nebraska has also explicitly said the following: the filing of the complaint rather than the entry of judgment frames the scope of litigation, establishing a transactional nexus into which facts and claims are fitted or excluded for purposes of claim preclusion, quote unquote, new claims arising after the complaint has been filed but before judgment need not be litigated in the first action. I say that all that because the tax the receipts that are in Exhibit 4 show that home buyers first made payment on the back taxes on February 2nd of 2019. The complaint filed by 11T was filed December 12th of 2018. The defendant's answer in that case, counterclaim and third-party complaint, was filed February 19th, 2019. So the payments that homebuyers, which is the sole member of 11T, would have made came after the commencement of the quiet title action. They made payments February 2nd of 2019 in the amount of $10,297.24. They also made payment on April 4th of 2019 in the amount of $1,468.76. So clearly, any of those payments made after the commencement of that quiet title action should not be precluded from this litigation. As far as Boone River, that they were brought into that case solely for the purpose because, as counsel had stated, they thought they had to. They named them. The interesting procedural issue here is that 11T, again, had nothing to do with the back taxes themselves that were set out in the tax certificate, which were the purpose of the quiet title action in the first place. Again, all these subsequent payments came after the fact. Boone River, though, clearly, by the evidence, made those payments. There was an allegation or again, a bond was posted in order to try to comply with procedural requirements that the party thought they had to comply with, which, as we learned in Adair, is not necessary. They did not need to post that. There was no motion for summary judgment order or motion for summary judgment which addressed the reimbursement of those funds. And Boone River being brought in as a third-party defendant, then we go back to Rule 61113 as far as their ability, their permissive ability, as to whether or not they actually wanted to respond to being brought into that case. Advantage Enterprises Inc. versus Caldwell really addresses and has not been overruled whether or not somebody is required to file a responsive pleading in those situations as well.
Is that the other case to which you were referring that was not in your brief?
No, and I apologize. It would be that United States District Court. I'm sorry, I didn't give you the citation. It was Info Group, Inc. versus DatabaseUSA.com, LLC, 814 CV 49, 2017, Westlaw 192-7360. Advantage is a Nebraska case, Your Honor, and it would have, it's from 1976. It states the general test to determine identity of causes of action is whether the same evidence will sustain both the present and the former action, and when it appears that different proof is required, a judgment in one of them is no bar to relief in the other.
Isn't there some overlap in the evidence that's going to be presented in Action 1 and in Action 2? In Action 1, the evidence that's going to be presented is, hey, we bought this tax certificate, we paid these taxes, we complied with these procedures, give us the deed, we have title. In Action 2, it's, hey, we bought this tax certificate, we paid these taxes, even if the deed fails, give us reimburse us for the taxes. Isn't there some overlap there. And you in your brief, rely on a case where this court said that breach of contract and quantum merit are the same cause of action. Isn't there some similarity here where one theory fails and then there's a sort of equitable backup, but it's the same cause of action?
Yeah, thank you, Judge. Respectfully, very little. The only thing that 11T needed to prove in its first case, in that quiet title action, was that the tax certificate, essentially that the entire process was done correctly. They needed to do that.
And part of that would be showing that they paid taxes to obtain the tax certificate, right?
That taxes were in fact paid, but 11T again didn't do that. It was Boone River that had paid those taxes. The process for having to prove the tax deed application process in 77-1801 at SEC, it's strictly complied. So it's a hardcore, you got to do everything by the book statute. So there's a great amount of evidence that needs to go on at that time. And in fact, they were they lost title because the procedural part itself of the tax deed application process was not done correctly. So there's
from a policy perspective, doesn't it make more sense to get this all sorted out in one action rather than in multiple?
As a matter of convenience, sure, it does. But that could be said in any number of cases. It's really not a matter of convenience. It's a matter of whether or not, when applying Vantage, if the elements in this unjust enrichment claim could be applied to that quiet title action and be successful in that quiet title action. And our position is clearly that that's not the case, that there's much more needed for that quiet title action to prove quiet title versus simply trying to go get reimbursement for the taxes in this case. I see I'm out of time, unless there are any other questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I don't believe we have time for rebuttal. So, counsel, no time for rebuttal. That concludes arguments in Boone River LLC versus Miles. Thank you both very much. You are excused. And the court will go on to the next case of the day, which is Sparks versus Mock.